Hello and welcome to the first in a series of Audible CPD modules called Hear This, which have been created by the Australian College of Pharmacy for the AJP. My name is Brett McFarlane, and in this series I'll be discussing clinical matters that are important to community pharmacist practice with experts and key opinion leaders in their area. Today I'm going to be chatting about drugs in lactation with Dr. Treasure Maguire. The module is divided into two parts. The first part is about lactation and the impact of medicines on lactation. The second part covers medicines in breast milk, how they can be passed from mother to baby and potentially cause adverse events. By listening to both parts, pharmacists can claim one Group 1 CPD credit. Members of the college can claim two Group 2 credits by logging onto our website after listening to both parts of this module and correctly answering the required multiple choice questions. I would like to welcome Dr. Treasure Maguire. Treasure is Assistant Director of Pharmacy at the Mater Health Services in Brisbane. She is a conjoint senior lecturer at the School of Pharmacy at the University of Queensland and Associate Professor of Pharmacology and Pharmacotherapeutics at Bond University. Treasure is also the clinical chair of the College Academic Board. Treasure works in a number of clinical areas, but perhaps most notably in obstetrics. So welcome, Treasure, and thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Brett. Lovely to be here.
The reason why we're chatting today is that we know that pharmacists have an important role to play in advising patients and parents about lactation and, of course, of the impact of medicines on lactation and the baby. But first of all, what's it like to work as a pharmacist with expectant and new mums? And what do they expect from you as the pharmacist?
I think to start with, and perhaps I'll show my bias here because I work in reproductive health, but it's a very rewarding area. As opposed to, say, let's pick the other end of life with geriatrics and palliative care. In reproductive health, you've got, and particularly in breastfeeding, young-ish, relatively healthy women who have moved from an independent life, particularly with their first baby, to suddenly being the primary health carer upon which this new infant is totally dependent. And so most mums take that responsibility very wisely, I guess, and suddenly things that might have been minor in their psyche become major. And so where they might be prescribed a new medicine, normally they'd be taking that in their stride, but now they're starting to think about what's the impact on another being, on my child. And so we need a lot of patience and to be prepared to provide a lot of reassurance. And I think part of the problems for pharmacists, if this is an area that they don't spend a lot of time in, they feel less self-confident, and that lack of confidence translates to how they handle these sorts of questions. So when we're uncertain, we pass on that uncertainty to our patients. And I hope today by this discussion that we can make pharmacists realise that this is an area that they need to be involved in. And it's not that difficult to become confident and competent in the area.
So do you think that parents are looking for advice from pharmacists? Are they happy to receive advice on lactation from pharmacists?
Definitely. Pharmacists are considered by most patients as medicines experts, and we need to be out there and wave that banner so that they'll come to us with these questions. But if you're asking, you know, in terms of information seeking about medicines, all of the literature suggests that we're one of the top two professions that patients will go to, their doctor, then their pharmacist.
So before we start to discuss the impact of medicines on lactation, could you give us a brief summary of what the benefits are of breastfeeding for the newborn?
Okay. There's an old adage that breast is best, and I would certainly not argue with that. But I think it is important, before I go into the benefits, to say that not everyone can successfully breastfeed. And it's really important that we're it isn't successful, that the pharmacist is not I'm trying to think of the right, a kind word to use, but we need to be sensitive to the fact that everyone can't be a successful dairy cow.
Yeah.
You know, in a herd of 100 cattle, there will be the really good milkers and the ones that aren't so good. And so we can encourage, but we shouldn't blame women if they're not successful.
Yeah.
Having said that, there are a lot of benefits, and the first is obvious, and that's nutrition. Basically, it's 150 ml per kilo per day of breast milk that the baby requires to grow and develop. And that's pretty easy when you've got a 3-kilo baby. You know, that's only, 450 mils. Once they're at 8 kilos or 10 kilos, to scale up to the extra volume and nutrition that the baby needs may be much harder. And so in some ways it's actually easier for the mum to feed the baby in the first few weeks to months of life than a six-month-old or an eight-month-old.
Okay, that's interesting, yeah. Because sometimes we sort of think about it the other way around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's why we need to introduce solids around about 4 months of age to give that additional nutrient. So nutrition is probably the most basic and the first, but I think the really other critical component is the immunity that can be passed on from mum to babe with the antibody transfer. And so even if a mother can only feed for a couple of weeks, baby still gets the benefit of the transfer of key immunoglobulins that can assist with a range of protection against infection, etc., as baby develops. So to me, nutrition and immunity would be the two key benefits.
So clearly benefits for the baby. In that respect, but one would assume that there's benefits for the mother as well.
And that's certainly the case, and it depends upon what you consider important. But I think overall for mums it's the bonding, the closeness with baby that can only really be achieved in a symbiotic way. Mm-hmm. You've had the baby in utero during the pregnancy, you cut the umbilical cord and suddenly you've got a separate entity and a way of regaining some of that symbiosis is through the act of breastfeeding. So bonding would probably have to be the really big benefit from the mum's perspective. But there are others, like convenience. You get up at 3 o'clock in the morning, it's much easier to put a baby on the breast than prepare a bottle of milk powder. So on the other hand, if you've got a partner, they can get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and give baby a bottle. And so it could be both an advantage and a disadvantage.
So you did mention before that some mums have difficulty with breastfeeding. And as pharmacists, we're commonly asked, is there any possibility of increasing breast milk production and for the mum, and are there any ways of doing that?
Yes, certainly, and we would routinely I'm at the Mater Hospital in Brisbane, and in our neonatal intensive care and our special care unit, we have mums who, you know, if you've got a baby in a humidic crib, you may not be able to have that touch and that ability to be able to breastfeed. But we still want baby in that setting, because of the immunological benefits, to have the benefit of the breast milk. And so mums will need to express, but don't have the letdown response that contributes to building your milk supply that breastfeeding allows. And so we will need to use some sort of augmentation for these mums. And the two main drugs that are used are metoclopramide, Maxelon, and domperidone. And it's been an interesting journey over the last probably 7 to 10 years. When we started off just with Maxelon, metoclopramide, and So it's the drug that has the longest history of both use and, in a sense, safety. But there's a downside. You need to have 10 milligrams three times a day. This is a drug that's not indicated either on PBS or even, you know, with private script for this particular indication. So the quantities are relatively low in a pack of metoclopramide, which means repeat prescriptions. So women often tend to eke them out rather than actually have to have 10 milligrams three times a day to work on the hypothalamic anterior pituitary cascade and get the relevant negative feedback mechanism to upregulate the milk supply. You also need to start the drug as soon as possible postpartum, that there is a recognition that there's a problem with the milk supply, and ideally within the first 30 days postpartum, because it's much harder to upregulate this process from an endocrine perspective if it's 45 days, 2 months postpartum, that all the mechanism is there in place to respond to the dopaminergic effects early postpartum.
So that's probably good for pharmacists to know, because if they are speaking to mums in their practice who are telling them that they're having what they believe is a struggle with their milk supply, that it's better to do something about it sooner rather than later.
Exactly. Mm. And I think mums struggle sometimes, and we're all saying give it another week or give it another couple of weeks, whereas really from a physiological and pharmacological perspective it should be within the first 30 days. Now it doesn't mean that there won't be outliers, that starting late, you know, it can still help, but this is where we're working with our physiology rather than against our physiology. And that applies to any drug use for augmentation, not just metoclopramide. So, adequate dosing within 30 days postpartum. Then the problem with metoclopramide is that it's actually a drug that works centrally on dopaminergic receptors. So, at the same time as working on augmenting the breast milk supply, you get all of the side effects that a dose-related use of metoclopramide would give you. And remember, we're dealing with infant exposure, and infants are at greater risk of extrapyramidal side effects. So whilst it's the drug with the longest track record of use and relative safety, there are still risks, which is why domperidone seemed to be a more viable alternative. Works by exactly the same mechanism of action, but it's more peripheral, less CNS activity, and therefore less extrapyramidal risk to the baby. So we went along for a number of years quite happily with everyone recommending domperidone. And then out of left field, the FDA in the States put out a warning about domperidone and its use in lactation augmentation. And if you actually drill down behind the scenes, a couple of interesting things. Domperidone is marketed by a European drug company, Janssen, was not actually available in the States. And so lactating mums were importing it from Canada illegally through the internet when they had poor milk supply. And so the FDA, in a sense, was trying to crack down on this importation.
Right.
And if you do the literature searching, there are cases of IV domperidone being associated with cardiovascular adverse effects in adults. But rapid, big doses IV of domperidone is not the same as a 10 milligram dose orally with what proportion would get through into the breast milk. So we have then this dilemma for clinicians. If I'm going just based on evidence and first principles, I would choose domperidone over metoclopramide. It's safer for baby, less CNS penetration. But to do that and to choose that as a doctor, I'm going against an FDA warning, even though the circumstances of that warning is very different. And this has led to quite a lot of debate and angst and controversy in the literature that pharmacists may hear snippets of or the patient may ask their advice on. And I think it's useful to understand that history. So people that are well experienced in this field, their preference would be in 2016 for domperidone.
Okay.
But you need to be sensitive of those other issues in discussing and reassuring the patient about why the doctor's made that choice.
And also for the pharmacist, it's important to, with that initial discussion, with the presentation of the prescription, to talk to the mum about what she's taking for, because obviously we'd be far more used to it being used for nausea and vomiting.
Exactly.
And so this is one of those unusual uses where you should get that straight before you start counselling about the other use for
it. Very much so, yeah. Because then you're only going to set up anxiety in the mum thinking, what's doctor given me this for? That's
absolutely
not what I went for.
Yeah.
And also when they read the CMI, exactly the same. This is a non-approved indication. So, you know, if you've got a practice with a lot of, or you're in an area with a lot of young mums mm-hmm. in your demographic, maybe you need to pull out some domperidone-specific information. There's a number of very reputable sites. The Mater where I work has a patient leaflet on domperidone and breastfeeding.
Okay.
So having some of those at your fingertips can be useful.
So there are some herbs like chaste tree and blessed thistle that we commonly get asked for. Is there any evidence supporting these for promotion of breast milk production, and are they safe in the baby?
Okay. I'm actually neither for or against complementary medicines. In fact, they form part of my integrative practice. So the moment I'm wearing a hat that isn't anti-CAM. However, there are the time and a place for when we use these, and we should always use any medicine based on evidence. And when it comes to complementary medicines in breastfeeding, think about the nature of milk and think about the nature of most herbs. So milk is largely a lipophilic medium with a bit of protein and electrolytes and a bit of water thrown in, but essentially it's a fatty medium.
Yeah.
That's what supplies the nutrient to baby. What are most herbs, or the active constituents of most herbs? They're lipophilic. So we've got now a scenario where actually there is going to be more of a preferential excretion into the milk, and that's been well demonstrated. You only have to have a mum using senna tablets for constipation, and baby will develop griping fairly quickly because there's a good penetration. So if we're after minimising exposure into the milk, probably a herbal CAM is not ideal. Secondly, whilst with some of these there is some small dopaminergic activity, to get the effect you're after of augmentation, and there have been a number of clinical trials that have tried to demonstrate positive outcomes, you need such big doses that you actually get the side effects in baby.
Okay.
So, you know, if we were talking ginger as an antiemetic in an adult, you know, there's really good evidence that it's on a par with many other alternative antiemetics. But in the setting of breast milk augmentation, you need big doses really risk outweighs benefit to both mum and baby.
That's really important then, because quite often we'll say that we don't know what the risk is, and so therefore you should avoid it just simply because we don't know. But then now we've actually got information that you can pass on to the mum why she should be avoiding.
And if you don't run into strife, usually it's because the dose is so low from the extract that's chosen, and that's when you need to be looking at the doses of, and people don't often, you know, when you look at the literature, give you solid evidence of what's the dose range you need to achieve this outcome. So, yes, if mum wants to use these products, then probably the best advice you can give is to talk about the fact there will be good excretion into the milk, and she needs to look for gastrointestinal symptoms in baby.
Now, of course, the mum might actually be taking a medicine for herself for treating a health condition, and it might be the medicine that she's taking which is the cause of her reduced or low milk production. What sort of drugs should pharmacists be asking about to determine if it is caused by that?
There's a number of medication that can be involved in reducing milk supply, and many of those are ones that we might think about when we're talking about geriatrics and Beers criteria.
Yeah.
Because when you think of, and that's something that pharmacists these days tend to be more familiar with, so you've got drugs that have anticholinergic properties which dry up secretions, but they're in everything from an antidepressant to an antipsychotic to a Parkinsonian drug, etc., etc. So I think it's... there's probably very few drug classes that we couldn't find some impact on breast milk supply, but the general idea is that mum keeps up her fluids, and if and 80% of these women, because of the letdown response and the upregulation of prolactin, etc., they're going to be able to overcome the effects, the anticholinergic effects of their drug therapy. So it's not going to affect everybody. So if 80% will be okay, you're then going to end up with 20% that may actually find either difficulty initiating and maintaining breastfeeding, or if a new drug is started, they'll notice that drop. And it's that group that we need to concentrate on and have the discussion with them and their doctor about risk versus benefit in terms of them ceasing or reducing the dose versus finding an alternative drug therapy for that indication versus ceasing breastfeeding because of the lack of success, not because the drug itself may be problematic.
Yeah, exactly. So how long do mums usually breastfeed for, and at what point in time is it common for a woman to start to consider weaning the baby from the breast?
Okay, now because I work with a lot of lactation consultants and women in this area, the time ranges from a day postpartum through to baby going to school and coming home from school,
right,
and having a breastfeed once a day.
Yeah.
And so there's two considerations. What is medically valuable in terms of breastfeeding for all the benefits we talked about earlier, nutrition, immunity, etc.? And the minimum for an ideal would be 4 months through to about a year. And after that, the benefits are more for the mum than the baby. Because remember, about 4 months, depending upon their gestational age at birth, is where you're starting to introduce solids. And
yep,
so the breast milk becomes a gradually smaller and smaller component of their total nutrient requirements. But in that first 4 months, when they're either, you know, ideally totally breastfed and this is their sole nutritional source, that's the most critical period. And then if I had to narrow it down even further, it's the first 2 weeks postpartum, because that's when you've got all of that immunoglobulin transfer. So I would encourage any mum, even if they don't intend to continue breastfeeding, to do it if they can for that first 2 weeks.
So sometimes weaning happens earlier rather than later, mm-hmm, and that could be because of, for example, severely cracked nipples, or if the mum has repeated cases of mastitis, for example, or if she's just concerned that the child is hungry or perhaps not thriving. And pharmacists will commonly be asked, if that's the case, if she is going to consider stopping breastfeeding, how can she stop her milk supply? How would you respond to a query like that in the broader sense?
That's a really big question. I think the first step is to understand what's driving the question. So is it that mum really wants to stop breastfeeding and is looking for an excuse? And many of the things you mentioned are good excuses to wean. Or is it the reverse? They're really, really keen to breastfeed, but they're in agony each time they put baby to the breast. For example, if they've got cracked nipples or mastitis. And if it's the latter, then our role is to try and help them through this period. For example, using moisturisers on the breast, particularly things that are more oily rather than watery, so not so much the lotions, but the more paraffin-based preparations to keep the breasts and particularly the nipples moist. And if you can prevent the cracks, then you don't end up with the fungal overgrowth, etc. If it is clearly mastitis, then you've got to look at what's the cause. Is it a bacterial infection, like a Staph aureus, a strep infection, or is there a fungal overgrowth? And so it can be treated either appropriately with antibacterial antibiotics or an antifungal agent. So getting that diagnosis right is important, because for the antibacterials you're going to have to on refer, whereas if it's a fungal infection you could treat either topically or with fluconazole. So trying to minimise the risk, and there's common sense things, you know, the mum is at greater risk if she's continuously wears tight clothing over her breasts. Mm-hmm. Poor hydration status, not enough sleep, etc., etc. So there's a counselling component to the prevention. If it's a treatment issue, then find the cause and manage that appropriately. But if we're going down the path of treatment, the really critical thing is that mum continues to breastfeed during this. Because one of the causes of mastitis can be failing to adequately empty each breast. And so remember the good and the poor dairy cows, making sure that you change from breast to breast with each feed. Some mums will feed on both breasts each feed, to try and balance things out. Others will feed fully from one breast and drain it and then use the other breast for the next feed. And whatever works for you. But what we do need to do is not end up with stasis of milk in the ducts. And so regular drawing off from both breasts, making sure that we empty the breasts. And if you've got so much milk and you don't know what to do with it, that's the time after baby's full to express and freeze the additional milk aliquots for those times when, if you have something like thrush, you've got some milk supply to offset and feed baby.
So there's a lot of considerations before you get to the stage of even contemplating taking some sort of pharmacotherapy to slow or cease milk production. Yeah. If we do get to that end, then are there any medicines available either over the counter or on prescription that can help or cease the breast flow completely?
Okay, so the agents that were used historically for drying up milk supply were ergot derivatives like bromocriptine.
Yeah.
And back in the 90s, we used to have a protocol of a twice-daily bromocriptine for 14 days. Because remember, there's been not 9 months, but a good 3 months at least in preparing the physiology for breastfeeding. That third trimester is part and parcel working on the hypothalamic anterior pituitary cascade to enable the mum to be able to breastfeed and then have the milk reflex from each feed augment or supplement that process. But all the preparations take months.
Yeah.
So you can't just say, I'm going to stop tomorrow breastfeeding and suddenly it's all going to stop.
Because I think a lot of people probably do assume that it's that quick.
That's right. Yeah. That's why it's important to think about this is really a third trimester preparation.
Yeah.
So the bromocriptine protocol of 14 days was about the time frame to start to down-regulate the milk supply. And then I think it would have been in the early 2000s, cabergoline, which is another ergot derivative, Dostinex is the trade name, came in as an alternative. And with good reason, it is less CNS active, which means there's a little bit less that gets into the milk, but it's got a really long half-life. And its half-life is, you know, its duration of action is about 14 days. So even though you may only have one dose or sometimes two doses of Dostinex, it's lasting for a couple of weeks. And I think the really important message for pharmacists is that when you get a prescription for cabergoline, you go out to the counter and you talk to mum, because often it's a knee-jerk reaction. Mum brings the baby home. Everything was fine in hospital. She's had nursing staff and other people to support her. She goes home, new mum. Milk supply hasn't come in as well as she'd hoped. She gets anxious. She's not getting enough sleep. Baby's waking up every, you know, couple of hours, 3 hours, and will wake up more often if baby's hungry.
Yeah.
So this vicious cycle starts: insomnia, dehydration, progressively more lack of self-confidence in her ability to be able to breastfeed the baby. And at some point she'll say to the partner, just go out and get me some bottles and some powdered milk, right? That's going to be easier. I can't take this any longer. Goes to the doctor the next day and says, I want to give up breastfeeding. And the doctor will write a prescription. Hopefully, you know, they've done the appropriate counselling, but they may not have. They rock into the pharmacist and they don't realise that this is irreversible in a sense. You know, we've got to go through another 9 months of pregnancy till everything's primed again for her to be able to breastfeed. So she takes the tablet. She thinks it's going to be easier, but now she's up making bottles. It's not quite as easy to actually sit up with the bottle and baby as to the baby
exactly.
on the breast.
Yeah.
And so maybe after a week they're going, oh, this is not all it's cracked up to be. I think I'll go back to breastfeeding. But we've given them a drug that's going to last for at least 2 weeks. And by the time it's worn off, it's much more difficult to upregulate that milk supply.
Right.
So they need to be really clear that they can't change their mind. And I don't think we're strong enough in getting that message across. It's not saying it's good, bad or indifferent. It's not saying don't take this drug, but just be prepared that this can almost be irrevocable.
So if obviously if someone's seeking advice from you prior to the prescription stage, that would be a really important thing to tell them.
That's right.
Yeah. And that process that you talked about before of the vicious cycle of the anxiety and the dehydration and everything, that's clearly going to negatively impact on herself and potentially on her milk supply as well. So that's important to address before a decision is made.
Exactly. Yeah. And that would be the time where I would refer them on to a lactation consultant.
Right.
And if, again, you have a population in your area, you know, it's a new housing development and you're the pharmacy in the middle of that, there's going to be a lot of young mums pregnant, breastfeeding, that will come to you for advice, and having an LC, a lactation consultant, that might do one day a fortnight or once a week in your pharmacy could be very beneficial, because then you can work together, you can cross-refer to each other, and it can be a good way of actually increasing your pharmacy business.
If we do get to the stage where a medicine is prescribed, are there any concerns about the two examples that you gave?
Well, I don't think you'll see bromocriptine used very often anymore. So basically it's Dostinex, cabergoline or nothing else. And in that context, There have been reasonable studies done, both controlled and a lot of observational data gathering, milk plasma ratios, etc. And the outcomes on the infant in that 14-day period where the drug is present in the milk have been very mild and minor. So I think the important thing is that mum continues to hydrate through that process, which slow, because it's better to have a gradual reduction in the milk supply than have it just stop overnight.
Right, yeah.
Both for mum and for baby. And apart from that, really, there's no major contraindication to using this drug. It's better with that long duration of action because you get less rebound effects where the milk stops and then it starts to peak again. But if you're going down this path, you then can't palliate baby at the breast because that's only going to try and stimulate your milk supply again.
Yeah, and one of the biggest difficulties that we find is the mother goes through all those problems that you talked about with the breastfeeding and slowing down the breastfeeding, not realising that the swap over onto a formula feed is just as difficult.
Yes.
And it brings in a number of other problems into the mix that they don't always consider, like constipation in the child and et cetera.
So it's about having the opportunity to have that discussion, making the time, because you may not initially get a sale from this patient, but they'll certainly come to you with their prescription if you've given them good advice with either a script for metoclopramide, domperidone or cabergoline, you know, one way or the other.
Yeah.
And once they recognise you as a quality source of information, you'll probably be that source through the child's infancy and school years, and there's lots of additional sales along the way. So I think it's a really good investment in some time early on.
That is the end of part one of this Hear This module on drugs in lactation. Pharmacists can claim half a Group 1 credit for listening to the content. For a further half a Group 1 credit, please listen to Part 2 of the module. Members of the College can claim Group 2 credits by listening to Part 2 of the module and then correctly answering the multiple choice questions on the College website.